Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Our Tennis Weekly crowdfund is now open. It's very, very exciting. Something we do every year. We are, of course, a by fans, for fans podcast. We have been going 6 seasons. We have produced 390 episodes, believe it or not. And we really do rely on our listeners to help support and financially back us to produce each and every episode throughout the season. So this is a really, really important time for us. I know we've got the quiz and it's all very exciting, but yes, the Tennis Weekly crowdfund is now live.
Yes, it's been an incredible year for us here at Tennis Weekly. And, you know, big thanks to our listeners for making that happen. You know, we had a really great engagement with our crowdfunder last year, and that meant we could keep going over the last 12 months to really grow the team and the podcast. As you know, Chris has joined us full time. We've been lucky enough to attend, you know, ATP, WTA and ITF tournaments as kind of media accredited journalists. And that means we've been able to get up close to pose some of your questions to top players. You know, Joel's spoken to Andy Murray, which, you know, I think he's still kind of recovering from that. But also the likes of Casper Ruud, Andre Rublev. We've been able to get more insight from top players to bring to you guys. And big thanks as well to our expanded team. We've had Alina and Christopher helping us in a volunteer capacity to really overhaul our visuals and social channels and produce the podcast as well when we're out and about. So massive thanks to everyone, listeners, volunteers and the wider team to help us do what we do and what we love to do.
And something that comes with all of this is that there is a significant cost to running a podcast. So whatever we get from the crowdfund and our sponsorship, we do reinvest into covering the growing cost of podcasting. And this covers things like our tech capabilities, our sound systems, the licenses for the software that we use, our website and social media fees. And if there's something left over, then we use it to support travel and accommodation when we attend tournaments so we can give you the ultimate fan insight into life on tour. And so it's these sort of costs and expenditures that make our annual crowdfunder so important to enabling us to keep running the podcast without too great of a negative balance sheet at the end of each year.
So listeners, if you want to show your support for the show, the Tennis Weekly crowdfund is open. We will put the link in the description. We are now with GoFundMe, and the link is www.gofundme.com/tennis-weekly-2024. That's www.gofundme.com/tennis-weekly-2024. We'll put the link in description. We really appreciate anyone who shows our support. If they can financially do that, that's great. But even listening to the show into 2024, it is honestly what motivates us to put scripts together. We do have full-time jobs, so we do this purely, you know, on the side, and we treat it, you know, respectfully and professionally. And when we get feedback and engagement, we see it on our social channels. It really kind of drives us to kind of continue and put out all of these episodes.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tennis Weekly with Joel, Kim and Chris. On today's end of season review, we speak with The Athletic's tennis writer Matthew Futterman and look back on the season that was 2023 on the ATP and WTA tours. Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to come onto the show at Tennis Weekly HQ. It's great to have you here to reflect on the tennis season that was in 2023. First of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. It's a nice time of year to be in the New York area, especially in New York City where I usually am. And so I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I mean, I feel like I'm just catching my breath. The tennis season is so long. I mean, it's the end of November, start of December, and we've got kind of this golden, I don't know, 3 weeks, I feel, before it all kicks off again for 2024.
Yeah, it's too long. There's no question.
It's too long. We need more. The tennis season needs to be longer, right? It just needs to be like one endless entity, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's just, it's too long. And I say, you know, and I don't, I mean, I say that for my own concentration level, but also, you know, I just really feel for these players and what their bodies go through and how they just don't have any, they have so little time to recover. And they talk about the off season.
There is no off season.
And there really is no off season. I mean, I don't know, they get like a week off and then they have to start training again and they, and I don't know, or 2 weeks, but I mean, it's really up to them. But I mean, if I had to be in Australia competing just after Christmas, that would probably wreck my December in terms of preparation and probably part of the end. I don't know. I guess probably I'd give myself to the end of November, but that's nothing. I mean, a lot of these players, you know, just stopped playing tournaments a couple weeks ago.
I know, it's crazy. And I know we've got exhibition tours. I saw Jannik Sinner. I think he's playing Kooyong as an exhibition event. He's not even playing a lead up to the Australian Open on the tour. So it just shows, I think, how crazy the season is. But in this episode, we're going to be looking back on the ATP season 2023. We're going to be looking back on the WTA season as well, 2023. We're going to be making some predictions along the way, as well as we're going to be breaking out some awards and some categories. I'm very curious to see what answers you give me. But first of all, before we kind of get into talking about the ATP season and reflecting back, for our listeners, you are the Athletic's tennis writer. I mean, what's your background in tennis? How did you get involved in tennis? And what is it about the sport that drew you in?
So I am a kid of the 1970s tennis boom in America, and you know, you name all the sort of classic characters: Borg, Connors, McEnroe, Everett Navratilova, Tracy Austin. You know, those were my people when I was a kid, who got me completely fascinated with tennis. I grew up about 10 miles from the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center, It was there in the very first year that the U.S. Open was held there, after it moved from the Westside Tennis Club in Forest Hills, which, I don't know, is a few miles away from where it is now. And I've just was hooked ever since. I played as a kid. I was, you know, not good enough to play in junior tournaments, but knew lots of kids who did. I ended up getting pretty good as I got a little older, or I guess getting pretty good. Good enough to play bad Division III college tennis in America.
That's what I like to hear.
Yeah, so it went 0-8 in singles my senior year, still trying to get over that all these years later. Probably not going to happen. So I've always been involved in it from that standpoint, from a participatory standpoint. And as a journalist, I sort of morphed into a sports writer about 5 years into my journalism career, and have been a sports writer for about 25 years. And tennis is just a sport that I gravitated towards because I knew a good bit about it. I had a sense of, you know, what the challenges were of, you know, trying to actually win points in games and sets and actual tennis matches. And, you know, was as soon as I started covering it, was sort of drawn to it, you know, as one would be drawn towards the sun, both figuratively and literally, because much of tennis takes place in the sun. And it's just, you know, it is an intoxicating kind of sport. And you know, this battle of wills, sort of like boxing without any actual hand-to-hand combat, but it looks pretty close to hand-to-hand combat. And it's, you know, I like to refer to all, I'm writing a book about the modern tennis tour right now, and the working title is The Cruelest Game. And that's really what I feel about it, is it is the cruelest game for so many reasons, and has a kind of agony and ecstasy to it that I haven't seen in a lot of the other sports I've covered, and I've covered many, many other sports, from, you know, World Cup football to all the Olympic sports, the NFL, NBA, pretty much covered just about everything in my career, other than cricket. I haven't written about cricket.
Yeah, it's definitely a very gladiatorial sport. I feel like that's why so many people get riled up about on-court coaching and how that factors in, where some other people just want singles players to think it out for themselves on the tennis court. So I kind of totally get that point of view. And it's great. I think we see, you know, we joke about the season being so long, but the fact is, like, pretty much every week of the year, we can see players in this context, you know, duke it out across the world. And, you know, we were speaking, you know, before we started recording about all the tournaments you've been to this season. I mean, you were recently at the ATP Tour Finals in Turin. And I've got to say, I think that was probably one of the best events of the season. I know, I mean, we normally talk about kind of the Grand Slams and the Grand Slam Finals, but I think you look back on Turin from a fan perspective anyway, when I was watching it on the TV, it just looked such a fun event to be at. I mean, what was your experience of it out there?
Well, it was very interesting, having been there the year before when there were no Italian players in the field, and then having gone and going there a year later, when Jannik Sinner was, you know, coming in on this incredible in great form and really sort of ready to pounce, and it really accentuated and emphasized this love that Italians have for tennis that I think is really underestimated, because they've so rarely had a great champion. And so I think Italy gets kind of overlooked as a tennis nation, and they've done so much work over the last, let's say, 10, 15 years in putting so many low-level tournaments there, challenger tournaments and ITF tournaments. And what you're really seeing is the fruits of that effort, because they have a hell of a crop of young talent at this point, whether it's Sinner or Musetti or Analdi. They've got a lot of good young men coming up, and to say nothing of Berrettini, who's been terrific for a while now. There is a real hunger there for great tennis, for great Italian tennis. And, you know, there were some ear-splitting decibel levels that you heard inside that Palais à Pittore.
I think Djokovic was orchestrating them at moments, yes. Wasn't he?
Yes, absolutely. And you love to see that. I mean, you love to see a home crowd getting on a visiting player, and, you know, as long as they're doing it and not sort of yelling into the serve or things like that. I mean, that's what sport is all about. Advantages, disadvantages, overcoming advantages and disadvantages. And that was all on display there. And so I think it's a pretty successful event, especially because I think several years ago when Turin was chosen, people sort of thought, wow, you're going from London to this small city in northern Italy. And so there was some sort of skepticism about it. But I think what Turin has showed is that, you know, if you can become a real event, you can pull people in from elsewhere. And it is rather centrally located, pretty easy to get to, especially from Milan. And that place is, you know, packed every night for every session. And it was really impressive.
Do you feel like this was the year that skepticism just disappeared? I was at the Davis Cup finals, and I think personally, I think this year with Djokovic there, Sinner there, you know, I think it showed actually this format can work. Did you feel like with the tour finals, particularly this year in Turin, the fact that, as I say, we got some great matches, do you feel like it sort of put the nail in the coffin of, like, actually, you know, Turin's had its time. Do we think about moving it again?
I think it probably will move at some point. I don't expect Turin to be the permanent home of it. But I think Turin has really sort of done its job. Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing that a city needs to do is fill the stands. And usually if you fill the stands, everything else takes care of itself. Because the top eight players in the world are there. So the competition is going to be there. You're going to get lots of three set matches, because they're so close in ability that there aren't going to be too many blowouts. So the competitive level is going to be there, and it's just a matter of getting, you know, bums in seats, and then everything, the atmosphere and everything else can sort of take care of itself.
Well, they certainly did that. I mean, looking back on the whole season on the ATP tour, I mean, what have been your overall impressions of it? Because, you know, in Turin, Novak Djokovic ultimately ended as the champion. It felt like at times, you know, this season on the tour that it just, whenever Novak Djokovic entered a tournament, it was always going to be him winning it. We saw it mostly with the, you know, the Grand Slams bar Wimbledon. I mean, what's your view on how the ATP season unfolded, you know, from the start of the year?
I mean, I thought it was a pretty darn good season. And especially it was neat to see Novak Djokovic sort of evolve throughout this season. And I think a lot of people forget where he was so recently. I mean, a year ago in Turin, he was playing there after having missed the U.S. Open, having had to hunt around the world for countries that would let him in because he's not vaccinated. And he played in Tel Aviv and, you know, was trying to get himself ready for the finals so he could come into form there. He showed up. He still didn't know when he showed up whether he was going to be able to even go back to Australia because his visa had been revoked and his lawyers were still working on a deal to get that approval. The approval came while he was there. But even once the approval came, I think there was a lot of question marks about how he was going to be received. He was a very controversial figure, not just in tennis, but also just in sport in general. And, you know, he showed up in Australia and was not comfortable there early on and sort of slowly got himself to a point where he was sort of comfortable with the crowd, but then he had this disaster with his father posing for a picture with a guy holding a Russian flag in the, you know, the terrible war in Ukraine is going on. So he was dealing with that, which earned him a lot of ire during that tournament in a place that was still in large part pretty mad at him from the year before. And, you know, he goes on and wins the tournament and then wins the French Open and, you know, gets to 23 and he becomes this sort of elder statesman and really sort of blossoms into this ultimate figure, not just in tennis, but also in sport. It's the, you know, the greatest who's ever played. And everyone sort of agrees with that. And then he sort of became something completely different the rest of the year in terms of carrying that mantle. I think he's really enjoyed it. I think it's calmed him down. I think he's soaking up a lot of adulation that he didn't used to get. Part of that may be because Federer and Nadal are no longer really playing, and Nadal's supposed to come back next year, but we'll see. And he sort of represents this golden era of tennis as the last man standing. And so, you know, you talk about it's hard to talk about the ATP season without pretty much only talking about Novak Djokovic, because I think people thought he was still going to be terrific this year. I don't know that anyone saw him winning three Grand Slam finals, making the final of the fourth one, and, you know, but for a wobbly floating forehand, he's probably wins the Grand Slam this year.
And also, he was very close, I would say, to winning the Davis Cup. You know, he's match points up against Jannik Sinner. It has taken some truly heroic moments, I think, from Alcaraz and Sinner, you know, to deprive Djokovic, arguably, maybe, of his greatest ever season. How far do you feel like Djokovic is out in front versus the chasing pack? Do you think over the course of this season, it's that distance has got greater and greater, and has that surprised you in some sense? You know, the fact with Carlos Alcaraz, for example, I mean, he won Wimbledon. Did he really kick on from Wimbledon though and challenge Djokovic throughout the rest of the year. I feel like that is up for debate. But how do you feel like Djokovic compares to the rest of the field?
So I keep going back to that sort of famous Andre Agassi quote about the problem with tennis being is that by the time that mentally you figure out how to play the game and how to manage the game, your body can't do it anymore, that it takes that long. And that Djokovic, because he has taken such immaculate care of his body, especially the last sort of, let's say, 8 years, five to eight years, because he was breaking down a little bit in 16, 17, around that period. He started to have some injury problems, but really since then, he has taken such immaculate care of his body, really sort of treating his body like an F1 car, and has gotten smarter as a tennis player as well, which is what happens to you when you play. The more you play, the more information you're gathered. You know, he's like an AI program where he's still learning, and he's getting more data and receiving more and processing more data. And so I do think, you know, at the moment, look, he's significantly out front of pretty much everyone else, especially on a hard court. And I would even say on grass, I think, you know, I don't know what the math said about what his win probability was in the second set tiebreaker, but it's probably pretty high.
Any tiebreaker, I feel like he just has it down, doesn't it?
And if he wins that set, he wins. You know, he probably wins it. Wins the match in three sets. And he has completely mastered grass. So, you know, fair play to Alcaraz beating him on his toughest surface. So yeah, I mean, at this point right now, I think he's a good bit better than most everybody. And I think, you know, this year end number one for him is somewhat astonishing, because he barely played. You know, I mean, he played the slams, could play Miami or Indian Wells. He wasn't allowed in the country at that point. You know, played a pretty sizable clay court season, or tried to, but didn't win all that much. And then played Cincinnati and, you know, Cincinnati, the US Open, and didn't go to Asia. He didn't go to Asia. He didn't go to Asia. He just played at Paris. And, you know, that's it. He played, I don't know, 11, 12 tournaments, something like that. Thing is, he won 7 or 8 of them. So he had this enormous point total, which is, I mean, you look at the other guys, you're playing 17, 18, 19 tournaments. So it's really kind of astonishing what he pulled off. In terms of Alcaraz that you asked about, I think he's still figuring out his body, which is something that Rafa had to deal with when he was that age. And so, you know, long term, Alcaraz is obviously going to be a huge star probably for years to come, as long as he doesn't sustain any really serious injuries. But he is going to have to figure out how to stay healthier.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Just going back to Djokovic, you spoke about him as this sort of F1 car, in terms of, like, you know, all the data he kind of brings in and how he's kept himself in immaculate shape. And I feel like Formula One has been a big talking point in relation to particularly the ATP Tour this season, because we had Breakpoint come out, you know, at the start of the season on Netflix. There's talk of the tour basically trying to emulate what, you know, Formula One has done and is doing. What did you make of the impact, first of all, of Breakpoint on the tour, in terms of how it was documenting the tour and how it was, you know, looking to bring in a new audience?
Well, it was interesting that so many players who agreed to cooperate with it broke down. And
yes, you know, the Netflix curse, I believe.
You know, yeah, something, I mean, that was initially sort of interesting. And you do wonder about a little bit of the Heisenberg effect there. You know, if you have a camera following you around in practice, are you training a little too hard? Are you going harder? Are you trying to impress the camera? too much. Like I do wonder a little bit about that. You know, but I do think it did. I heard from a lot of my friends who were not serious tennis fans that they had indeed watched Breakpoint and had been interested in it and had enjoyed it. So I think it served its purpose in a lot of ways, because I think that was the main thing that tennis wanted to do. And I know Andre Gaudenzi, who is the chairman of the ATP Tour. I mean, I think he feels like that non-match programming is almost as important as match programming these days, or at least moving forward, and that it's going to be very important moving forward to the promotion and growth of the tour.
Yeah, it's certainly, I think, become a bit more of an entertainment business, you know, this season. Whether that's, you know, I think it has both good and bad sides. I think it can bring in new audiences, but I also think there are probably diehard fans out there who think it's a lot of just kind of white noise around the main event, which is just kind of let's keep focusing and talking on the tennis. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I know there's a new season on the horizon, so we'll have to see how that develops and whether you know the numbers hold up. But I think it's been an interesting kind of look at how the tour, as I say, has almost kind of taken Formula One as a model and has been like, well, in order to go forward and evolve, we need to kind of look at how we do that. I mean, just looking at the Grand Slams, I mean, we had the Australian Open, French Wimbledon, US Open. The only winner was Novak Djokovic and Carlos Alcaraz. Did it just quickly feel like a procession when it came to the Grand Slams? It did feel like it needed a moment of magic just to kind of stop Novak Djokovic in his tracks.
Well, what I was, I think what I kept coming back to and sort of have concluded somewhat at the end of the season is just how that, you know, the original next gen group, sort of Tsitsipas, Medvedev, Zverev, I don't know, would you put Shapovalov in that group? He's about that age. He's 25 or so. He's probably turning 26 fairly soon. You know, that whole crew, how it looks increasingly with each passing month, almost in each passing year, that they may very well be getting passed over.
Yeah, I agree.
That they're just...
It's just stagnated, I feel, this season, arguably.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Zverev had that bad ankle injury, but I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure if he's won a grand, if he would have done, if his, other than playing more, I'm not sure if his ultimate results, his ceiling would have been all that different had he not had that injury. Tsitsipas seems to be not getting better at the moment. You know, Medvedev has his one Grand Slam win, but I'm not sure he's getting all that much better at the moment. Played a great match against Alcaraz, but you know, Sinner seems to, at least judging by the end of the season, may have passed him. I'm not really sure, but he certainly had his number in the fall. And I mean, that's also, I do look, you know, very skeptically at what happens after the US Open. Everybody's pretty burnt out. A lot of people are banged up. There's a lot of easy appearance fee paychecks to be made in Asia. I do wonder how hard a lot of times the people who win are the people who have decided they really want to try hard at that point in the year, and they have a huge advantage over everybody else. So, you know, we'll see what Jannik Sinner does, you know, starting in Australia. I don't think he won't be great. He certainly seems like the kind of individual who should be great, but you know, the star of the fall of 2022 was Felix Auger-Aliassime, and it's a much different story for 2023.
Well, I would say that the one of the star players of the fall of 2023 has been Ben Shelton, and I wanted to ask you about your views on USA men's tennis, because I think at the start of the year they had 10 Americans in the top 50. Feels like they've got like a lot of names now, you know, back in, they've got kind of strength and depth there. Maybe they don't have someone who is like got that top five potential at the moment, but How have you looked back on the men's performances on the tour, as well as the team as well? Because we didn't see them at the, you know, the Davis Cup in the final eight, which to me was also a little bit of a surprise.
Well, I asked Taylor Fritz, and I saw I was with him in Turin, and I said, you know, I said, what kind of grade do you give yourself for this season? And he kind of got this sour look on his face, and he was like, I don't know, B minus. He was pretty, you know, and I think a lot of the players might give themselves a similar grade, except for, I mean, and I'm excluding Shelton, obviously, because he's, I don't, but in terms of the other players, the names that have been more familiar, I think they might all give themselves around that grade, with the exception being Tommy Paul, who, you know, certainly made big jumps this season. I think significant jumps into, you know, top 16, I think is about where he is right now. He certainly was there in the last couple of months and has some, you know, beat Alcaraz in Canada, and, you know, was quite competitive with him in Cincinnati and semifinals, the Australian Open. So I think he has a lot to be pleased about. But Francis Tiafoe, no doubt, is disappointed. Mm. He made the top 10, feels good about that, but that's not really, I think he saw himself playing in a Grand Slam final this year. Fritz, same thing, you know, really underperformed in the Grand Slams until you got to the US Open. And I think he still feels, even though, you know, no shame in losing to Djokovic in a Grand Slam, but I still think he feels like he served pretty poorly that during those 2 weeks in that match, and would give himself, you know, going out in three sets like that, he would not give himself a good grade for that tournament as a whole.
What is the feeling around kind of Ben Shelton? Because I think, you know, everyone knows him for the, like, the, you know, the phone hand gesture he gave Novak Djokovic. And is he kind of bordering on confidence versus arrogance, perhaps? And maybe you need that at a young age, coming onto the tour and making a name for yourself. But what do you feel like the expectation is of, you know, Ben Shelton from the US press in terms of where he should be going and what he should be looking to achieve going into 2024?
I mean, the people smarter than me, then smarter than anybody in the press. So, you know, people like Patrick McEnroe and, you know, the people who are really good at tennis and know this stuff. I mean, they think he's the most likely one to win a Grand Slam.
Wow.
And they think he probably should, in the next 5 years or something as he evolves. I mean, he can serve the ball 150 miles an hour. And the only people who really could reach that level that the game has seen were, you know, 2 meters tall, or, you know, for the American audience, you know, 6'7", or 6'9", you know, John Isner, and they were going to have Riley Opelka, and they were going to have real issues, you know, in rallies, when the points move beyond the serve. Ben Shelton is a hell of an athlete and a great mover, and is so raw at this point. You know, didn't play the junior slams growing up, didn't leave the country. I mean, didn't have a passport until last December. Played college tennis, won the NCAAs, if you think of how little, if you put Novak Djokovic on one end of the spectrum in terms of the amount of data that he has in his brain, I mean, put Ben Shelton all the way at the other end of the spectrum. He just hasn't hit that. I mean, he's just hit so few balls at this level. So, you know, you get, and he's, you know, he's a smart guy and, you know, a hard worker and wants to be good and just has a desire. And I think it would be really hard to take any 20-year-old who makes a Grand Slam semifinal in the men's game the way it is these days and not be pretty optimistic about his future, much less someone who does it in his first, you know, his first season on the tour with that little tennis behind him. So, I mean, I think the idea is that you know, the ceiling is just as high as it could be for him.
Yeah, I agree. I think what I've been impressed by has been how quickly he has taken to the tour, and it'll be exciting to see what happens next season. But we're going to move on to some Tennis Weekly awards for the ATP Tour in 2023. Now, I gave you some categories earlier in the week that I'm very curious to see what answers you're going to give me. I've given you five. We've got five awards here. We've got favorite match of 2023, surprise package of 2023, most improved player, biggest disappointment, and three words to describe the ATP season. We haven't got a lot of time, I think, before we go on to the WTA. So I'm going to give you the category. I want to hear your answer. Is that all right?
Yeah, sure. That's fine.
Okay, right. Favorite match of 2023?
So I'll go very generic, but I don't know how you could not say the Wimbledon final. And
wondering if that was going to be your answer.
I mean, it's sort of like, you know, and I don't think it's as bad as saying like your favorite Springsteen song is Born to Run, which is not my favorite Springsteen song.
Okay.
But I don't know how. Yeah, I mean, this, you know, it had everything. This generational battle. It was a rematch from 3 weeks before, or five weeks before, whatever it was. It was center court. It was 5 hours. It was a miraculous comeback. I mean, you know, the good fortune and blessing of my life is, you know, I was sitting 10 rows up, so, or whatever. Okay. It was.
I'm not going to hold you then to what I was going to say is probably the most predictable answer. But what about the next category? Surprise package of 2023.
Well, I think, how is it not Ben Shelton? Right.
Yeah.
I mean, go through everything I just said about him. I mean, no one saw him doing anything like this. He made in the quarters of Australia on his first trip outside the country. It was ridiculous. And then, like I said, the improvement, and it was a bit of a, you know, he struggled for many months, which is normal.
Yeah, I agree. I was going to say, I think it was a surprise given the start of the season he had. It wasn't, I expected more from him actually in the grass court season. As you said, he's got a big serve on him, and it didn't feel like it quite clicked when it maybe should have. So
he'd never walked on a grass court.
It was like Bambi on ice.
He never walked on a grass court until, I mean, I can look up, I have to, I would, I should look in my calendar, because I interviewed him, I think the day, it was like June 11th or something like that, you know, and I was on the phone with his dad, and he was like, yeah, we got in yesterday morning, and we went over to the All England Club and hit for a bit, and that was his first time. He had never set foot on a grass tennis court. In, you know, there's not that many of them in the U.S., but he'd never been to Newport. He'd never been to the handful of. He'd never been out to East Hampton where they have them in Long Island. I didn't expect it. I mean, yeah, great serve, all that, but I mean, I've played on grass like once or twice in my life and wanted to run away from it. And the ball doesn't bounce above your ankles. So, and it took, I mean, so I'll be fascinated to see what he does on grass next year. But this year, I mean, crazy.
Right. Most improved player of 2023.
Most improved player. I'd probably say Tommy Paul.
Okay. Yeah. We're differing on answers here, actually, for the first time. I went Jannik Sinner and his level against top 10 players.
Well, yeah, he did have a lot of wins. He did have a lot of wins against top players.
I mean, what was it about Tommy Paul you think you've seen that has made him your most improved player?
I guess the biggest thing is his attitude. He's really, you know, he's a person who's sort of struggled with his head, and he seems really serious about getting about being as good as he can possibly be these days. And in addition to that, he his all court game has just become a whole lot different. He's coming in more. He's got good touch, and you know, I think that there was a lot of matches where you looked at him on the schedule last year and you said like, oh, Tommy's good. Tommy should win that. And then he didn't win it. And so he would be out in the second round or something like that. And that just really wasn't happening very much this year. And you know, he can go toe to toe with, look, he can really go toe to toe with Alcaraz. He's beaten him twice. Not a lot of players have done that. And he can, and I think that says a lot to him. And I don't think that a lot of people would have predicted that for Tommy Paul.
What's been your biggest disappointment of 2023?
So I hate to use the word disappointment because I feel like it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with me. But in terms of, I think the player who's most disappointed in his season is probably Ogier Aliassime at this point. I think he really expected big things of himself this year.
Why do you think it's not panned out? Because he had such a fantastic end to the 2022 season. What was it about this season you just don't think helped him continue that momentum?
Well, I think he's got two issues. I think he had some injuries. He and Shapovalov were both sort of limping around throughout the summer, and were struggling with injuries. And you know, in addition to that, I think his plan A has been so strong and taken him so far that I think he hasn't really developed a plan B, you know, which you sort of need seemingly against those top 10 players. And I think that's one of the reasons why he brought in Tony Nadal to help him sort of develop that, but it hasn't been quite there. And then, you know, and especially in the Grand Slams, he seems to, you know, getting pushed by players who are not nearly as good as him in the early rounds, and he sort of freezes up. And I'm not sure if he knows why he does that. And I think he's quite hopeful that if he can get healthy, that he'll have a bounce back year at 24.
Yeah, he definitely has the talent too. So we'll have to wait and see on how that develops. I mean, the last category I had was three words to describe the ATP season. What are your three words of choice?
I would say the first two are completely opposite because one is predictable and surprise. One is predictable. The other is surprising.
I feel like you've been looking at my script because I've also got predictable as one of my words.
Yeah. So both predictable, surprising, and I will also throw in there disappointing, because Rafa wasn't able to play after January 18th or so, or whatever that date was, and I think most tennis fans wanted to see a little more Rafa and Novak, especially after the way 22 went, and Rafa was really in such great form until the quarterfinals of Wimbledon, really. And so I think in that sense, a qualified disappointment there.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I've got predictable, I've got procession, and I put transition as well. I feel like this season, I still think we're in a sort of transitionary phase, and you know, Novak Djokovic has asserted himself at the top, and I'm still kind of waiting for that moment to happen. I think we got like a false dawn perhaps when Carlos Alcaraz defeated him at Wimbledon, but I still think we're in a sort of transitionary phase, and as a result, maybe to me it's a little bit kind of weaker than when it was set with, you know, the big three or the big four. And it's this opportunity now, I think, for Novak Djokovic to just, I don't know, for me it's just this opportunity now for him to mop up and sweep up all the tournaments, because it doesn't feel like anyone's close to him at the moment.
Yeah, he's pulled everything back. It pulled everything back his way.
Right. I'm going to ask you for some predictions now for 2024. I would just like one name for each of these categories I'm going to give you. So you ready?
Sure.
Right. Year end ATP number one at the end of 2024 season.
Alcaraz.
Your Grand Slam champion at the Australian Open.
Djokovic.
French Open.
Alcaraz.
Ooh, Wimbledon.
And I'm saying Alcaraz, but because I don't think Rafa's going to be in the physical shape at that point.
Wimbledon.
I hope he surprises me. So I'll give Wimbledon. I'll go back to Djokovic.
And U.S. Open.
It's somebody in center.
Yes, I've got Jannik Sinner as well. I think US Open, as you say, it's towards the end of the season. I mean, it's an Olympic year as well. It's going to be even more punishing of a season. And I always think that the US Open is prone to throw up surprises and first-time champions. So I've also gone Jannik Sinner there.
Yeah, and Djokovic is really going to bust his ass to win the Olympic gold medal. I mean, it's the one hole in his resume.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Who is going to be your gold medalist at Paris 2024 in the singles?
I guess I'll give Djokovic the, you know, when he seems to want something really badly, he seems to get it. And, you know, I could almost see him like, you know, well, he doesn't play any grass court tournaments other than Wimbledon anyway. So it's not like, but I think he's going to play, maybe he'll play one clay court tournament before.
Interesting.
French Open is my guess. Cause he's really talked about how he's going to have to manage his calendar next year. So, you know, he'll probably play Monte Carlo because he can sleep in his own bed. Maybe he'll play Monte Carlo and Rome. And that's it. He won't, you know, he's not gonna waste his time in Spain, in either Barcelona or Madrid, or, you know. So I think I think he's really gonna have to be careful.
And before we go to a quick break, what is your one bold out there prediction that nobody else would make?
Well, I don't know that no one else would make, but I think Arthur Fils is going to be a massive star by the end of next year.
Okay, interesting. Top 10? Top 20?
So I don't, I think certainly top 20. But I'm thinking more of like, you know, he's going to have one big breakthrough thing. He's going to have one big breakthrough and like make some semifinal or something like that. And I mean, you can't watch him and not like completely fall in love with his game and his demeanor. And, you know, look, if he wasn't doing this, he'd be starring in films he's that good looking and modeling or something like that. So he's the kind of person that like, I have three daughters, and when they've seen him on TV, they say, "Who is that?"
Oh wow! I mean, I have seen him in person, and Chris, one of my co-hosts, he thinks he's got big things in store for Arthur Fee as well, and he has got a very like, it looks like a very seasoned and a very well functioning body. It feels like for someone who is so young, particularly when I compare him to someone like, you know, Jack Draper from a British point of view, who I still think has like work to do with his body to get it up to the rigors of the ATP tour.
Yeah. It seems like Arthur, if you took Draper's head and Arthur's body, you'd probably have a top four player right now. Maybe you need, you know, but yeah, Arthur needs to get his head under control a little bit better. But Yeah, so I mean, he would be 19. He's going to be 19 next year, so he's still pretty young. So I guess that's a fairly bold prediction that he's going to be a big star in the game by the end of next year.
Well, we shall wait and see. I mean, my one bold prediction was Andy Murray will retire after Wimbledon. So listeners, make of that what you will. But we're going to take a quick break now. Do join us in the second half where we're going to be looking back on the WTA 2023 season. So do not go anywhere.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome back to the Tennis Weekly podcast, and now we're going to move on to talk about the WTA season that was in 2023. I mean, Matt, where to start with the WTA season? Because I feel like I want to talk to you more about all the off-court shenanigans that has gone on with the WTA, you know, the business side of things, organizational side of things, because as much as I want to talk about Iga Świątek and Aryna Sabalenka, I feel like we've got to start with Cancun and just the sort of the catalogue of errors it has felt at times that the WTA has made this season.
There's no question that they just didn't. You can't imagine how they could have messed that one up more, given how predictable it was that they were going to have to find somewhere else. It's sort of mind-boggling that it took so long for them to A, make a decision on where they were going to relocate the WTA finals, and then to make sort of such a bad choice, and then have such a predictable outcome of, you know, empty stands and terrible weather.
It was really, I think, the icing, you know, on the cake of the season. I think we've seen players, you know, embroiled with the the chief exec Steve Simon, like, you know, seeing that spill out on social media, like Rybakina, and it feels that it's been quite messy at times, and it's sad because I think you look at the players that they have on the tour at the moment. I think particularly at the top of the game, they really have, I think, strength in depth at the moment. There's lots of characters, there's lots of quality players, and you've had players, I think, announce themselves this season at that very top. You know, players like Coco Gauff in the during the hard court swing and the US Open. But before that, I mean, we had Iga Świątek, who it felt like she seemingly dominated, you know, the 2022. We were talking about, you know, the streaks that she was going on. And it felt like this season she didn't necessarily have it all her own way. Yes, she did end up as the WTA end of season, you know, number one. But how would you assess Iga Świątek and her season in terms of how it went? Do you think, like, it was a good season from her point of view, or do you think there was room for improvement?
Yeah, I think by what should be the realistic standards of a tennis player, then look, she had a really good season. She ended the season as number one and she won a Grand Slam. So if you're a professional tennis player, you kind of have to sign for that.
But by Iga Świątek standards, do you think that's the same case?
I think it should be, considering that she doesn't really, that she hasn't really tried that hard at it and really doesn't know how to play on grass. So Now you're down to three grands. Now you're down to three grand slams. One of them, you know, I think people would say like, well, she's going to win that one for the next 10 years.
It's like a Rafa situation.
Because she's so good on clay. I don't necessarily agree with that, actually. Because I do think there are players who can sort of match her on good days there. Then you have Australia and the US Open. You saw how hard it was for her to win the US Open the year before. She doesn't really like New York. It's a battle there. She has a hard time getting into the proper headspace. I think it's an outrageous year if you win two Grand Slams. If you win one and you end up number one in the world, then that's pretty terrific. I don't know how many years you're going to see someone have 37 match winning streaks on the WTA tour. It doesn't really happen all that much. So I think, you know, our expectations got sort of ruined for players over the last 15 years by, you know, Serena, Rafa, Roger, and Novak.
It's interesting. I haven't really thought about it like that. But I mean, what did you make of the fact that, you know, we didn't have Naomi Osaka on the tour this season? You know, her absence, what impact do you feel like that had on the tour? And do you think Naomi Osaka, it sounds like she's going to be coming back next season with a proper schedule. Do you think that is, you know, if you're in the, you're at the top of the rankings, like Iga Świątek, are you concerned? Are you worried with a fit and, you know, motivated Naomi Osaka coming back to the tour?
I think they're in a, I'll see it when I believe it, mode at the moment. I don't get the sense that Naomi Osaka has really factored into a lot of top players' thinking in terms of, you know, capital N, capital O, Naomi Osaka, you know, the Naomi Osaka that we saw when she was in her peak form for, probably 2 years at this point. The last time I think she was really thought of okay, Naomi's going to be a force was at the 2021 US Open when she was, you know, defending champion and, coming back fairly strong from a bit of a layoff and came back at the Olympics and, you know, did all right, you know, under a tremendous, tremendous amount of pressure, but then had that real struggle and that real breakdown. And I don't know that ever since then, wasn't great in Australia that next January. And then since then, it's been, you know, she hasn't really factored that much into people's planning and in their minds. And, you know, when she gets out there and starts beating people badly, then they'll start thinking about her again. But tennis is very much a show me sport. And, you know, she's going to have to show some people that she belongs with them again.
I think going into next season, we've got a lot of players who, you know, will think that they have credible opportunities to win Grand Slam titles, because in 2023, I mean, we had Sabalenka win the Australian Open, defeated Rybakina in the final, and a great entertaining final in three sets. As you said, French Open, Świątek defeated Karolina Muchová in three sets. And then perhaps the most surprising final of all, we got Wimbledon, Vondrousova defeating Onzu Bor 6-4, 6-4, and then Coco Gauff defeated Sabalenka at the US Open. I mean, which of those kind of Grand Slam, you know, finals sticks out to you? Because, you know, for me, I feel like the GB nation, the UK nation, I think wept for Onzu Bor, you know, in that Grand Slam final against Vondrousova. I think everyone kind of felt like it was her moment. You know, she'd been in Grand Slam finals before. She'd had that experience, that learning curve. She, you know, was going to approach this with the right mindset, but ultimately it just didn't. Again, it just didn't happen to her against a fit and firing Marketa Vondrousova.
Yeah, the one that really sticks out for me, and I'll just show my bias here, is obviously the Coco, the Coco final at the U.S. Open, which was just a kind of magical moment for American sport, certainly. Mm. And, you know, and I think tennis as well, because, you know, this is not necessarily a criticism of Iga or Sabalenka or Rybakina, who are great champions and, you know, may end up having better careers on paper than Coco. But in terms of a kind of star power and transformative, you know, transformative draw that she brings to the sport, none of them, I think, really approach what Coco has. And I mean, and I referenced my three daughters before. I'll reference them again, because they are, I mean, they're between the ages of 17 and 24, and they are just obsessed with Coco.
What is it about Coco Gauff that you feel that gives her that star power that feels like transcends tennis into new audiences?
You know, she's funny. You know, first, you know, she's funny, she's bright-eyed, she's real, she's authentic, she's emotional, she's not afraid to show her emotions, she's not afraid to be vulnerable, and she just has a really good head on her shoulders, and she has had a good head on her shoulders ever since she appeared on the scene. I mean, just go look up the speech she gave at the Black Lives Matter march in Florida when George Floyd was murdered. And that was in 2020. And so 3 years ago, she was 16 years old at the time. And, you know, you have this, I don't know what you were doing at 16 years old, but I wasn't giving speeches about the biggest, you know, civil rights moment in a generation, in front of thousands of people, and doing it with the eloquence and poise that she was doing. And so, and that is her, you know, she's just unafraid and honest. And, she just has a cool about her. You know, and that just shines through. Then when she, you know, she fought back and she won, and she just, you know, goes into the crowd, and she's in that sort of puddle of tears with her parents. And, you know, that's just kind of a magical moment in her home slam. You know, this young Black girl, playing a sport that, you know, a generation and a half ago wasn't really all that open to Black girls, and now is, like, you know, the obsession of Black girls everywhere in America. These are sort of larger themes that she hits on, that is something that you sort of can't really buy in terms of story quality and narrative and publicity for a sport.
Yeah, and there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, she brought on Brad Gilbert into her team over the summer, and that, I think, you know, you could see it had a big difference on the court. Where do you think Coco Gauff goes from here? Do you feel like she's, like, ready to have a crack potentially at like a world number one singles ranking, you know, next year, or do you think there's still work to be done to get to that point where you're fighting with the Swiateks and the Sabalenkas of the WTA Tour?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think she has a Swiatek problem. You know, that is a tough matchup for her, as the record yeah, will show. You know, but it is, but I think it's, I don't know that she'll ever even out that record or go on a roll, but I mean, it's solvable. People get, you know, things happen. People get hurt. So Swiatek will go into a slump. You know, a lot of this is time, you know, things never go as we predict they might or think that they might. You know, Swiatek might lose early one tournament. Like, it's going to happen. It happens to everybody at some point. So, but I think she's every bit the player of Sabalenka and Rybakina, certainly given her age at this point. I mean, she's 19 still.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's always the thing you sort of forget with Coco Gauff, is that she's still so incredibly young.
Yeah, and she didn't even expect herself. I mean, I'd asked her last. I think she said she thought she was, like, in Australia, I think I asked her, and I think she said she was about like 65% of the player she thought she could be. Mm-hmm. And she had sort of studied it, and she went through it and was like, look, if you look at when most players win their Grand Slams, it's between the ages of like 21 and 26. She's like, so I think, you know, I got a couple of years to go, and I'm going to get there, and I'm going to get to who I'm going to be when that'll happen. And so if you think of her in those terms and think, wow, she's still got 2-3 more years before she gets to who she thinks she can be, that's going to be a pretty good player.
Definitely. And I mean, just reflecting on US women's tennis, and we've spoken at length about Coco Gauff. The other player up there, I think, leading the charges is Jessie Pegula, Coco Gauff's doubles partner. I mean, what do you make of Jessie Pegula? Because I still feel like we're still in that waiting, can she go further in Grand Slams? Yes, she's a consistent threat on the tour, but do you feel like there's, again, still potentially work to do there in order to realize maybe her ultimate goals of getting, first of all, to a Grand Slam final?
So I do think she can go further. I mean, like, she should have won that match against Vondrousova. Was she up four? She had a point for 5-1 in the third set, right? You know, she should win. She's going to win that match 90% of the time, probably. She didn't on that day, so certainly she can. She can go farther. It's just a matter of sort of like putting her head together and getting across the finish line. Can she win a Grand Slam? I mean, if you look at the players on WTA Tour who have won Grand Slams, then I don't really see like why she can't.
At some point, I find it tough. I watched the WTA finals in Cancun. That, you know, she lost to Świątek. You know, won in love in the final. I'm just like, there's times when I'm just like, her ceiling is not high enough. Right. Maybe.
No, I'm not talking about like whether her ceiling is high enough to beat Świątek, but Markéta Vondrousova won a Grand Slam without beating Iga Świątek. Yep. Like, you don't always have to beat Iga Świątek to get into a Grand Slam final. Sometimes you only have to beat, you know, sometimes you only have to beat Elena Svitolina and in the semifinal and on Shibor in the final. And if Pegula ended up with that, had gone through and ended up with that draw, like, maybe she's the Wimbledon champion. Mm-hmm. Like, she might be. So, so can she? I think it would be sort of irresponsible and just silly to say she can't. Like, if she and Iga Świątek played 20 times, do I think she'd win? The Iga would probably win 17 or 18 of them, probably. But maybe the trick is just not playing Iga Świątek or Sabalenka. Yeah, I mean, like, and that happens. I mean, just look at who has won.
Yeah, Raducanu
finals. Yeah, Raducanu won a Grand Slam final. Sofia Kenin has won a Grand Slam final and made another one. You know, it Mukova, who I think is the most beautiful and either one of the top five players in the world. I mean, she nearly won a Grand Slam final this year. So, look, you know, it absolutely can happen.
Just on, you know, we spoke about Pegula and Gauff. Does it feel like USA women's tennis is like the spotlight is firmly on those two? Because you mentioned Sofia Kenin. I thought she had a little bit of a Yelena Ostapenko type resurgence, you know, this season. You've got Madison Keys as well, just outside the top 10. I mean, are there any other names that impressed you in US tennis this season? Or was it just the Pegula and Gauff show the majority of it?
No, Peyton Stearns impressed the hell out of me. She's great.
I'm annoyed you said that because I still remember her defeating Katie Balter, Britain's Katie Balter in at the US Open. And I thought that was like, this is a good matchup to get, I think, to round four of Flushing Meadows.
Yeah, and that was a that was a weird match because it got moved.
It was on late, wasn't it? It was four people there. Yeah.
Yeah, I was one of the four for a little while. And Peyton Stearns was not going to lose that match. Mm. She was just like,
I mean, where's Peyton Stearns come from? She come from college tennis?
Yeah, she was the NCAA champion at Texas. And, you know, you talk about somebody else who, like, you know, put her in the Ben Shelton category of having played very little grown woman tennis before she won the NCAA championship, and she is a battler, and she's really learning. I mean, she beat Ostapenko at the French Open in a match that I don't think anybody thought she was going to win. And she, I think, can probably count on two hands the number of red clay matches she had played before the French Open this year. I mean, very, very few. She had very little experience on it. And, I think she's someone nobody really knows, but like I think she's going to be a very, very solid player for a while.
Well, we're going to move on now to the Tennis Weekly Awards once again for the WTA season 2023. So favorite match, surprise package, most improved player, biggest disappointment, and three words to describe the WTA season. Let's start with favorite match. What was your favorite match on the WTA tour this season?
So I'm going to go back to I'm going to set aside the Coco Gauff final, because obviously that for reasons would be a favorite match, but it was it wasn't all that competitive ultimately. it was not a great match at the end. So in Indian Wells, Peyton Stearns played a match against Bianca Andreescu. That was an absolute slugfest, and it went three sets, and it was one of those sort of like Indian Wells field courts matches where the crowd is there and it's loud and it's right on top of the action. And you just had these two women going at each other, and it was tight, and it was Andreescu bringing the full Andreescu. And, you know, I just love she's my favorite player to watch probably on the tour. And so that was really a match that like sticks out in my head. I just remember being really happy. I remember sitting on that field court, and I don't know what else was going on in that tournament at the time, but I did not want to be anywhere else. I didn't care. I didn't want to be anywhere else, but watch but in the middle of the desert, you know, in the third row, watching these two players play.
Yeah. Yeah, I had that, and what my favorite match was, which was do you remember Svitolina versus Azarenka at Wimbledon, which I thought was very highly charged, quality tennis. I've been surprised with how well Svitolina has come back since coming back to the tour. I've been very impressed, and I think it was
Now that you mention it, I'm kind of sad I didn't put Svitolina and Swiatek at Wimbledon slot.
There was some fantastic matches in that in Wimbledon. Also Swiatek Bencic, I don't know if you remember that one, but Swiatek was very close to going out against Bencic.
Bencic had match point, I think Iga said that was the only time in her life she'd ever come back from match point down.
Well, there you go. Right, let's move on. Surprise package of 2023.
Mira Andreeva.
Ooh, I like it. That's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, was she 15 when she showed up in Madrid and, you know, just started basically beating everybody?
Are you expecting her to be a future, I don't know, slam champion, world number one in years to come, or are you sort of nervous, like, I don't know, she's peaking too soon, or she's just going to get stuck, or where do you see that kind of progressing?
I feel like if I answer that now, I'm going to have to come up with another answer for one of my later
hold that thought then. I'm going to say Alina Svitolina because of the way she's bounced back, and coming back to the tour after a long period off, it is no certainty. It is very, very hard to do. I think we see that sadly with someone like, you know, Dominic Thiem, for example, on the men's side. There's no guarantees you're going to get back to where you were. And I was impressed with how ready to go Svitolina was when she came back to the tour. So I've got her as my surprise package. What about most improved player of 2023?
I would say Coco.
Yes, I've got Coco as well.
Yeah. And even the most improved player, like, within a 4 month span of 2023, like, she was, I don't think she was thought to be ready to win a Grand Slam in the spring, and then by the end of the summer she was clearly.
Yeah, and you know, the worry I had was, you know, when she was winning those tournaments in the build up to the US Open, I was like, has she peaked too soon? So I was almost like pleasantly surprised she went on a fantastic run and became US Open champion, because it was duly warranted, I think, from all of the improvements that she's made with her game. And I think that, you know, the changes that I think she also made to her team, you know, with as I said, bringing Brad Gilbert on board, I think, you know, that was a very wise move, and it seemingly paid off for her. So yes, I agree with you there. Biggest disappointment of 2023.
Again, I'm going to qualify this with player who is going to be disappointed in themselves, because otherwise I feel like it's me being mean. I don't ever want to be mean unwarranted. These players are, for 95% of them, are trying their best all the time and working really hard. But look, Emma Raducanu is probably completely shattered by the way her 2023 went. She didn't want to end up with, you know, two wrist surgeries, right? And not being able to play for most of the year. And, you know, and she's another person that the sport could really benefit from having. She's could be such a bright light, and she's, you know, really going to be starting from scratch.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be fascinating to see how she comes back. I don't even know at the moment if she's going to try and play the Australian Open, we'll have to see how that develops. But from a British point of view, I think we've really missed her. Although I will say, you know, Katie Balter has done well, I think, in her absence. I mean, she's now pushing, you know, top 50, won Nottingham Open this year. I think she's really, really developed, and I just feel like if Raducanu can come back and show some of that tennis and be fit, fully fit on the tour, I think British tennis will be in a good place. I mean, my disappointment was Ons Jabeur not winning Wimbledon, because I was there for the ladies semi-finals there, and I watched her beat Sabalenka, and it was a fantastic topsy-turvy match. But to do that and then not go and get the job done against Vondrousova, I think it was, yeah, that will sting for her, given she'd been in that situation now multiple times. And I was very kind of disappointed for her. But I'm hoping that, as I say, that story is not finished, and next season she can go and, you know, perhaps get revenge and right the wrong of that story.
No reason that she can't.
No.
Like I said before, there's no reason she can't. She might need some breaks along the way, but she certainly, you know, she's been within a set before, so she should get there.
So three words to describe the WTA season this year. What are your three words?
I would say scattered, enticing, and at moments thrilling.
Oh, lovely. I can tell you're a tennis writer. I it's hard to disagree. I've gone for chaotic. I'm talking more to the WTA kind of business side there. Quality, because I just think, you know, we've got like so many great individuals, and entertaining. I think there's more depth there, and there's more rivalries, and there's more combinations that can create great tennis on the WTA tour at the moment versus the ATP tour. I know there's a sort of Djokovic is the ultimate end boss, and you know it's thrilling to see if someone can defeat him. But
there's a lot of good there's a lot of good first round Grand Slam matches in the WTA tour these days, which you can't really say about the men's tour.
Yeah, great.
I mean, maybe there's one, like, you know, like in the first couple of days where you look at it on paper and you go like, oh wow, that's a real popcorn match. But like every Grand Slam, like the first couple of days, because there's a lot of former champions who are still playing well, but may not be, you know, seated or seated high. And like Ken and Coco Gauff first round Wimbledon was like, whoa, that's a real match.
I know. It's like how is this a round one match?
Yeah. So like, and that happened round two, it happened, and it's even more in round two. Like it gets very real very quickly, for the WTA tour.
Okay, we're going to move on to some predictions for 2024. Again, similar to ATP, I'd love to hear one name for each of these. Year-end WTA number one ranked player.
Yeah, Iga.
Yeah, I've gone Iga Świątek as well. Okay, Grand Slam champions, Australian Open.
God, this, you know, it's so much goes into this, but
are you going to say Peyton Stearns?
I'm not going to say Peyton Stearns, but I'll probably say Rybakina.
Oh, okay. French Open?
I'm going to go out on a real limb here. I'm going to say Coco.
Oh, interesting. Not Świątek. Wimbledon?
Why not? Let's get Ons Jabeur over the finish line.
US Open.
Iga.
So I've gone Goff Australian Open, Świątek French Open, Sabalenka Wimbledon, Świątek US Open. So yeah, I've got Iga with two trophies, but yeah, maybe we're differing on our opinions, but yeah.
I just think at some point Coco's gonna win the French Open and win it, and maybe I'm choosing a bad year for it. But I think that's something that how good a player she is on clay always gets, she's already, she made the French Open final at 17, right? She didn't play a great final. She played poorly there. Oh no, excuse me, at 18, against Iga, she lost to Iga, but she gets more time on her forehand on clay and it makes a massive difference. Mm. And she's hugely dangerous. And especially now that she knows how to play a little differently with Brad Gilbert showing her the light a little bit. I don't know. I think she's really dangerous on clay. That's why I say it. I didn't want to just say Iga because that's boring.
I mean, naturally, this does bring me on to the fact that, Paris, it's going to be at Roland Garros, Paris 2024. Who's your gold medalist?
Iga.
Okay, right. And what is your one bold out there prediction for the WTA Tour?
I forecasted this before, but I'm gonna put Mira Andreeva in a Grand Slam final.
Wow. I'm gonna timestamp this. You heard it here first. Mira Andreeva in a Grand Slam final next season. I'm curious, have you got ideas on which one it might be?
I don't, because I don't think she cares.
Okay.
I think she doesn't care what she's playing on. I think she just sees the ball, hits the ball. She was asked maybe a queen, not a at Queens, but what at one of the tournaments, maybe it's early Wimbledon. Like, are you finding it weird to play on grass? I don't think she played on grass before. And she's like, nah, it's not weird. It's just tennis.
It's just tennis, yeah.
And it was like, really? And like, but that's who she is. She really doesn't care. Like,
okay,
put lines on a court, put lines on a ground, give her a racket and a ball to hit, and she's ready to go. And she'll rip your throat out before before she leaves it. She might rip her own throat out too, but she's just like a gamer, so I am very high on her future.
I'm fascinated to see now how she develops next season. My one bold prediction was Serena Williams will play the US Open. I don't know why I've written that down, but she always, I feel like, teases us on social media with her playing tennis with Venus Williams on a tennis court. But for some reason, I've just got that in my head when I was writing out my predictions. So
singles? Are you thinking singles?
I'm not gonna go that specific at the moment. I'm gonna say maybe Serena Venus doubles. Let's stay with that. I don't feel like they've had that moment. But yeah, I could see that happening. Just chuck them a wild card and just give them that moment. I think potentially could happen.
Okay, I can see it.
Right, Matt, thank you so much for coming on to the Tennis Weekly podcast. I've got one final question for you. It's a question we ask all of our guests who come onto the show, and it has nothing to do with tennis. It is to do with the fact that we are a British tennis podcast. We love our tea at Tennis Weekly HQ, and we've got to ask you, Are you a tea drinker or are you a coffee drinker or what's your
100% tea?
Oh, okay. What's your tea game?
So this is, by the way, this is why this is like I'm much more of a England person than a France person.
Okay.
You know, because like I don't like wine, I like beer. I don't like coffee, I like tea. I can go down the line. I'm much more. So what is my tea? You mean like what brand or what flavor?
Yeah, and milk, sugar.
You know, I would love sugar, but I try and keep off it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I have some soy. I generally soy milk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Generally soy milk, and you know, it depends on the time of day. I guess ideally start out with a little Irish breakfast or something. You know, middle of the day. Depending on how sleepy I am, maybe English breakfast or Earl Grey. Sometimes the afternoon, move to, you know, a chai or something like that. So yeah, I drink a lot of tea, and when it gets hot, I just switch to iced tea.
Oh, okay, yeah. I mean, that is lovely to hear. I think it sounds like you've got a very kind of sophisticated. You know what you're doing when it comes to your tea drinking.
I do think about it. I mean, like I always have tea bags in my backpack when I'm traveling around.
It's got to happen, yeah.
Right? Because like, I mean, Roland Garros, you can't get tea, but you can get hot water.
Okay.
So I have tea bags in my backpack during the day when I'm there.
Well, listeners, there you go. I've enjoyed our review of the 2023 season with Matt Futterman. Matt, you're on social media. You are the tennis writer for The Athletic. If our listeners are interested in following you and your articles for The Athletic as well, do you have a social media profile? If you do, let our listeners know now.
I sure do. I am on, you know, X, the social media site formerly known as Twitter, at Matt Futterman. I would say I'm on it for now. If Elon Musk keeps behaving like he does, I may not be on it for long. And I'm also on Facebook, Matt Futterman. You can find me there. I do have an Instagram handle, but I'm not very good about using it. So stick with the other ones.
We'll put the Twitter or X link in our description, and we'll also put a link as well to The Athletic, because you produce some fantastic articles. I've been reading a few of them in the build up to this.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that, and I appreciate you having me on this podcast. It's terrific.
Well, thank you very much for coming onto the show. But listeners, I hope you've enjoyed our latest episode of the Tennis Weekly podcast. Remember to subscribe to us to stay up to date on all the action to come in 2024 on the ATP and WTA tours. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcasting platforms out there. And if you like what you're hearing, then make sure to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also follow us on social media or email the show. We're on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and X at Tennis Weekly Pod. You can purchase Tennis Weekly merch at xe.com/shop/tennisweeklypodcast. You can email the show tennisweeklypod@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out our website, tennisweekly.co.uk. But for now, we will be back next time for another episode from Tennis Weekly Podcast. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from me, and I'll see you again soon.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.